Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I'm Mike Rowe, and this is a brand new show. It's called Returning the Favor.
I've never really tried one of these before, man. It's exciting.
The goal is pretty simple. Introduce America to regular people who are doing something nice.
Till Donovan started his donations. These bins down here used to run empty.
I seen a problem. I wanted to do something about it. And that's what we do. We do something about it.
And then surprise those people by doing something nice for them.
We're going to give a car.
We're working on it.
There's no way that I could expect that people would do something nice for us.
It's a completely transparent look at the neighbors you wish you had.
I'm willing to put myself in harm's way to protect my country, and I'm willing to deal with the consequences of that later.
This has to make you feel better than any other project you've ever worked on in your miserable career.
Here we go.
It's a fine line between hosting a show and being in the way.
Searching America for better than average citizens, and then returning the favor.
Day player on 720 WGN. You know Mike Rowe from his days as the host of Dirty Jobs. He's the host of Deadliest Catch on the Discovery Channel and host of the new Facebook show, Returning the Favor. And he's also CEO of Mike Rowe Works. And joining us to talk about, well, the low employment rates and the skills gap and his new series is Mike Rowe himself. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks for having me back, Dave. I assume I must have said something mildly cogent the first time.
You did. You did.
Good.
You won a second appearance, and I appreciate it. congratulations, first of all, on the new series. I just caught the first episode. Love it. And at a time where politics, our country, so divided, it's a great show celebrating those who help others.
Honestly, thank you. And for the first time, maybe not the first time, but, you know, Dirty Jobs in a lot of ways was a mission-oriented platform proposition more than it was a program. You know, I was just kind of Forrest Gumping my way around the country looking for people who weren't afraid to get dirty.
Sure.
This came out of the same kind of idea that I'm just feeling like people don't care about shows anymore in terms of plot and character and all the normal stuff. They're just tired of, you know, going into their news feeds and seeing themselves unfriended by people they thought they'd be pals with forever.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know,
no,
turning
totally
on cable. And
yeah.
I mean, it's just a bloodbath out there, and people are, the country's sad. This is a nice, happy show.
It really is. It really is. And the first episode about an Army veteran who started this organization to help his fellow veterans overcome post-traumatic stress disorder. It's like you said, you know, if I'm going to invest my time in a very busy week to something quality, I want to learn something about something new. I want to feel good. I want it to inspire me.
I mean, do you really want to be left, with respect, you know, knowing a real housewife a little better? they're just, I mean, it's a choice,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
But, you know, for me, honestly, the second most important thing, along with doing a show that didn't make people throw up in their mouth, was doing it in a way that didn't feel overly manipulative,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and toward that end, really what I pitched Facebook was, let's do a making of a feel-good show, about a feel-good show. Let's just throw everything onto the screen. Because a lot of the producers, you know, the guys I'm working with on this thing, they've all done their time in traditional reality TV. And the truth is, they want to do something different.
Yeah.
And they want to do something that's, you know, kind of decent. So far, I mean, it's been the feel-good hit of the summer.
But everything you've done, though, I feel is that way. I really do. I do feel that way. Like, the Somebody's Got to Do It, the Dirty Jobs. You've always kind of taken that approach. And I think that's why those shows that you've done have been so successful and so engaging for the viewer.
Well, look, thanks. I mean, it's not so different in your industry, you know, in radio, in publishing, in anything. The kinds of shows and the kind of people I find myself drawn to more and more are people who seem to be primarily doing whatever it is they're doing, not to amuse me, but to amuse themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, those people are typically in on the joke, whatever that is. And so, you know, with Dirty Jobs and with this show as well, I just tell the people around me, look, think of your friends, think of your family, imagine sitting with them and watching whatever it is we're about to do That should be how you feel. That
sure.
You should have the freedom to say whatever fool thing pops into your mind that you would say if you were watching with your pals, because that's ultimately where you want to be, right?
Yeah.
You want to be with your friends.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But what I like about this one too, Mike, is that not are you only highlighting what this individual has done for others, but you give back as well to that individual.
This is where it gets a little, I won't say predictable because we're not being cute about it. But look, Jason Zaidman, he repairs motorcycles with fellow vets who don't know anything about repairing motorcycles and aren't mechanics. And what he discovered putting together a very old motorcycle in his garage was that it completely took him out of his head. It took him away from any issues he may have had.
Yeah.
And so he started doing the same thing with friends who had gone through similar events overseas. And to a man, they all experienced the same thing. It's part Zen in the art of motorcycle repair maintenance, but it's bigger than that. So all we really try and do at the end is surprise them by doing something, giving them something that will allow them to do more of what they're already doing.
Yeah.
So in this case, it's more gear, it's more equipment, it's a better garage, it's a better looking garage. And of course, it's publicity, because what Jason really wants to do is take Operation Combat Bike Saver.
Expand that.
And see it pop up in Cleveland and Akron
and
Dallas, Baltimore, and why not?
Yeah.
Facebook is David, this is such a different world. I mean, if I got 2 million people watching Dirty Jobs, or 500,000 watching Somebody's Got to Do It, the network would send flowers and we'd have a small parade. we're reaching millions of people overnight.
Yeah.
It's a kick.
It's addictive. And in fact, I was going to ask you, like, how often are you planning on, is it going to be a little more random, or do you have a kind of a schedule on how you want to do this and release more of these?
Well, no one knows what success looks like. No one is sure of anything. We're going to do 10, and I'm going to put up a new one every week for the next 8 weeks.
Okay.
And we'll see where we are, but,
This is new territory, but look at this. 5 million viewers are on Facebook already. I don't think I've ever gone to Facebook specifically like as a destination to watch something.
No.
And you're making me hungry for the next episode.
Well, the crazy thing for me, I've been very transparent with the 5 million friends I have on my page. And about 6 months ago, my mother wrote me this letter. It was one of the funniest things I'd ever read. So I immediately read it out loud and posted it. And 62 million people have read it so far watched it.
Yeah, right.
I think, I can't prove it, but I think somebody over at Facebook looked at that and said, the guy's sitting at his kitchen table telling me a story and 60 million people are watching. Do we really need, to spend Game of Thrones money to get a decent show on the air? I mean, do you really need to go that far underwater? The answer is, of course you don't.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And all this, coming from a guy with all the success you've had over the years, and I love talking about this, so I'm going to throw this in here. You started off as an opera singer. That's always my favorite story, because anytime I've shared it with somebody, when I've shared the interview that we had about a year and a half ago, everyone's like, "Wait, what?"
Look, it's really interesting to me. When you look at how hard it is for people to get their heads around cognitive dissonance today, it didn't used to be this hard. Like a well-rounded person was not a surprise. And I'm not suggesting I'm well-rounded. Maybe I'm just schizophrenic. But if you juxtapose a lot of the images out there of me crawling through sewers or dangling from, the Mackinac Bridge with a guy, singing an aria from Puccini, it does not compute. But it doesn't compute either. If you look at really the most important gig I ever had was selling crap in the middle of the night on the TVC cable shopping channel.
Right.
I learned everything I needed to know about this ridiculous industry at 3 a.m., talking to a couple million narcoleptic lonely hearts. And so there are no insignificant jobs.
Nope.
And the most interesting rungs on the ladder, I bet if you look back at your career too, you can identify jobs, people, moments that seemed completely insignificant and maybe even a little embarrassing at the time, But in hindsight, put you on the path that took you to wherever it is you are today.
Oh, I'll tell you, one of my first gigs was working for the music industry for Musicland, Sam Goody. Remember record stores?
Oh, very well.
But really, my first job was working for my town's water and sewer department, and I built creek beds with railroad ties and painted fire hydrants. And you're right, there is no insignificant job, and I think that's one of the big things out there right now is everybody has this view of what the perfect job is. And I just want to segue a little bit to this cool foundation you have called Micro Works. And it's, you know, it's the relationship with work, the widening skills gap. You award scholarships to students pursuing a career in skilled trades, which brings me to this unemployment and skills gap. So in the U.S., we have a record 6.2 million job openings. It's the highest number since the Labor Department started tracking this in 2000. At the same time, there are 7 million unemployed Americans, and that's almost one job for every person searching for a role. But the skill gap proves that opportunity alone isn't enough to find the right job.
That is as good a synopsis as I've ever heard of why I do what I do with this foundation. The first reason, you know, is simply to address the portion of the country who's come to the mistaken conclusion that opportunity is dead. The skills gap, you know, is not a political issue, but it becomes political because it highlights an inconvenient truth. And the truth is there is a ton of opportunity for anyone willing to learn a skill that's in demand and go. And I don't want to minimize this because it's not like all the jobs exist in equal part in every zip code, fairly. They don't. You have to go to where the work is, but, well, isn't that always been the way? But if you look at the skills gap as an indicator of something else going on in the country, that's where it really becomes interesting to me. So the legacy of dirty jobs, to the extent that it has one, is an attempt to close that gap by rewarding a combination of work ethic and competence that everybody I met on the show possessed and every business owner I met on the show cried out for. Even at the height of unemployment, you know, the height of it in 2009,
sure. Right.
Everywhere we went, the only sign I saw was help wanted signs.
Well,
and that's amazing, and it's no different today.
And you think about, you know, when I was in high school, I mean, there was vocational technical training that's taken out of the high schools now, so we're not even really providing those opportunities to learn a trade at an earlier age. And although we'd like everyone to think differently, college isn't affordable for everyone, and it might not be the right path for everyone. But we don't early enough in kids' lives give them some different opportunities that they may not see.
We tell kids what's valuable by the way we treat everything around us. So what is a logical kid to conclude if you take the vocational arts out of high school? The grown-ups don't value it. Why in the world would he or she? And by the way, it's interesting. You know, vocational arts is what shop used to be called.
Shop,
and,
right.
You know, the first way you get rid of something almost always is to arbitrage the art out of it. So the vocational arts simply became vo-tech, and vo-tech simply became shop. And shop was easier to remove from high school than anybody imagined. So we don't elevate the kinds of jobs that are critical to civilized life.
Absolutely.
We don't celebrate a whole category of our workforce. And yet we're surprised because a generation later, we can't seem to recruit people into those jobs. And at the same time, of course, we've loaned over $1.3 trillion
College. Yeah, right.
For a four-year degree.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I got one. I'm happy to have it. But, man, we're still lending money we don't have to kids who can't pay it back to educate them for jobs that don't exist anymore. And that's kind of bananas.
But there's, a perception of what, you know, once you graduate college, let's say, or once you graduate high school, trying to figure out what you're going to do is what the perfect job is and what the expectations are. And sometimes skilled trade, that doesn't even come up in conversation. I think about what's going on in Texas right now and what's going to have to be rebuilt down there. And I wonder to myself, is there going to be enough skilled individuals to go down there and get the job done at this stage?
Well, the short answer is no.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Right.
But the real interesting observation in what you just said is, will there be enough skilled tradesmen to go down there? because what that presupposes is that there were never enough skilled tradesmen there in the first place.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely true.
Yeah.
The, you know, we're already 225,000 tradesmen down from where we could be right now. And the shortages in that part of the country are already the most keen. So the only way that place is going to get built is built back is if people come from someplace else and dig in for a while. And I'll tell you something else, Dave. It's not so different on the federal level right now. You know, regardless of what you think of this administration, the idea of pouring $1 trillion into infrastructure is based on this assumption that there is a workforce that's trained and skilled and standing by to do all that work.
Or unemployed.
It's not
right?
there either.
It's not there.
It's
either.
Not there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're like talking right past each other on a national level. And it's really interesting that there was a couple of months ago, there was a conference or a summit or something where the president said, you know, we're going to bring these jobs back. And all the CEOs kind of looked at each other and said, look, Mr. President, we already have the jobs. We can't find people to do them. And it's a subtle but massive disconnect. And for whatever reason, it still doesn't make its way into the headlines nearly enough. I appreciate you asking me about it because that's, you know, to the extent that I can move the needle, that's exactly where I try to.
Yeah. And you wrote, and I'm following on Facebook, you wrote a letter first to President Obama, and I saw it, and this is months ago or whatever it was, but, and then you literally kind of took that letter and scratched out the name President Obama, put President Trump in there because it really was the same issue.
Not a damn thing.
Unaddressed.
Except it got worse, right?
Yeah, and right.
I started MicroWorks on Labor Day in 2008.
Right.
And I wrote a letter to Obama right after his inauguration where he talked about 3 million shovel-ready jobs. And I said, look, I'm not an expert, but from what I'm hearing and from what I've seen, you're going to have a much easier time selling shovel-ready opportunities to a country who has a positive relationship with the shovel. And right now, I think that might be broken. So I essentially wrote the same letter to Trump. I just crossed out Obama's name and crossed out 3 million and put in $1 trillion of infrastructure spending. And he saw it, and I wound up getting invited to D.C. and once again beat my shoe on the table and yelled at Congress.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, you push the rock up the hill and see what happens.
Yeah. What's your overall vision for this then? Is it taking some of that money that we were going to put into the infrastructure and actually put it toward training people who want jobs and that don't currently have those skills? I mean, what's your vision on this?
Well, my optimistic spin on it is that these things always course correct. It just takes time and it's messy and it's very uncomfortable for a period. We're going to see that in Houston, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But I think more nationally, we're just going to have to wait while the companies who ultimately get the bids are able to train a workforce. It's not, you know, it's bad, but it's not dire because, you know, if you're a fan of history at all, you know, you'll recall the Second World War and you'll recall the speed with which the entire country had to figure out not only how to build B-17s, but fly them.
Right.
And, you know, we can do it. You know, we just need some sort of existential reason. And bridges falling down is not war, but it's up there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, floods are up there. You know, when that was really the thing about Dirty Jobs. It was to get people to think, look, this is a fun show and we're having a lot of laughs, but you have to ask yourself every so often what happens when all the plumbers call in sick for a week, you know, or the electricians. Yeah. The steam fitters, the pipe fitters.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, unlike most other vocations, which would cause problems, this, you know, is riot. This is, you know, end of days stuff. So we either tend to our workforce or we pay the price.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you, we have to teach these American trades and kind of recalibrate the expectations in the job market. And until we do that, you know, we can't move the needle.
Well, you're talking about job satisfaction,
you
know, which I think is exactly the the issue because it's also the problem. We're telling kids right into high school, you know, that the key to being happy in your work is to correctly identify the job that will make you happy. We might not use those exact words, you know, it's kind of like talking about a soulmate. You know, if you want to be happy in your relationship, you have to find the person who will make you happy.
Yeah.
And job satisfaction is no different. It's horrible advice. But again, the big takeaway from Dirty Jobs was, how come all these people doing all these things that I was told historically would make me miserable are having such a good time?
That's true.
And so, yeah, this whole conversation, you know, is informed in part by what is meaningful work and what is happiness on the job? What is real career satisfaction and how do you get it? And my suspicion is you get it by setting the table in a completely different way.
Absolutely.
Right from the jump.
Absolutely. He's Mike Rowe, his wonderful new series, Returning the Favor, on Facebook. And for more on Mike, follow him on Facebook, MikeRowe.com, and his foundation is at ProfoundlyDisconnected.com. Mike, always great insight and always a pleasure hearing from you.
Dave, anytime. Let me know. It's the feel-good hit of the summer.
Okay, thanks, buddy. All right, top stories are next on 720 WGN.